Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. Few people understand much of that war, and particularly one of its key battle spaces, namely Asia, better than our first guest. He is Gordon Chang. I'm very pleased to say a weekly contributor to our program, as well as a columnist for The Daily Beast, a contributor to Forbes.com, WorldAffairsJournal.com, Fox News, and much, much more. The author of two terrific books, The Coming Collapse of China and Nuclear Showdown, North Korea Takes on the World. Gordon, it's great to have you in the house. Welcome back.
Thank you so much, Frank.
Gordon, Xi Jinping, the Communist Party chief and president of China, today marked the anniversary of the founding of the People's Liberation Army and used the occasion to unburden himself of a very bellicose speech about China's military power, its place in the world, and in particular, that it would not allow its territory to be divided. In connection with this question about how Chinese people are responding to this appeal to nationalism, would you just talk a little bit about whether there's now a new spring in their step, as the Wall Street Journal recently suggested, a new sense of pride that the Communist Party, with all of its problems, political, economic, and corruption and otherwise, may nonetheless be able to play, to hold on to, and perhaps even intensify. Talk about the takeaway from that, both for his principal audience in China and for the rest of us.
Xi Jinping's strident nationalism does strike a chord with China. The Chinese in general, of course, want their country to be strong. But also, at this moment, the Communist Party is having severe problems in maintaining the loyalties of the Chinese people. You know, we see this with the increased cynicism. We see this with protests on the street. And also, I think people are much more concerned at the end of the day about the economy, because the Chinese economy, although it's growing, it is only benefiting certain portions of the Chinese electorate. Xi Jinping appeared in battle fatigues, which is an indication of his state of mind. He's extremely nationalistic. He's been driving the reclamation of the islands in the South China Sea. He's been pushing out borders. You know, we see, of course, the standoff in Dak Lam, where we have Indian and Chinese troops very close proximity to each other, neither side willing to back down. This is after China tried to build a road in Bhutan. Also, Chinese troops are now another incursion close to New Delhi. This is a leader who believes that China's moment is now, that the United States is finished, and he is willing to try to do anything or almost anything to push his borders out beyond where they are now. This is a dangerous thing because he's setting the tone in Beijing. We are seeing this in a number of different instances. He's becoming increasingly predatory in his trade practices, trying to close off the Chinese market to foreign competitors. When you look at China, it's hard to find any good trends on the part of the government. And so, therefore, we've got to be concerned that we're dealing with a very new China with different ambitions. I can't think of a more serious competitor to the United States at this particular moment. And so, therefore, at this point, it's a very unhappy country. And that's one of the reasons why Xi Jinping is doubling down on nationalism, which is extremely dangerous because the Chinese people don't have a say in where their country's going. And so Xi can take China at a point where he sees a closing window of opportunity. He's arrogant. He sees the United States receding around his periphery. And so I can't think of a more dangerous combination of attitudes right now on the part of the Communist Party.
Not least in light of its very considerable ramping up of its military capabilities and, as we'll be talking about shortly with Kevin Freeman, its increasing capacity for economic warfare against us as well. Against this backdrop, Gordon Chang, as you know, President Trump has been signaling a determination to start holding the Chinese accountable for not doing more to actually bring the North Koreans to heel. What is in prospect there, do you think, Gordon? This certainly doesn't sound as though the Chinese are going to take that very well.
There have been a number of messages from President Trump recently. The most important is the two-part tweet on Saturday where Trump challenged the entire basis of U.S.-China relations, talking about how foolish it was for his predecessors to permit trade to allow the Chinese to earn hundreds of billions of dollars a year from the United States. Trade is absolutely vital to the U.S., but our president has opened an important conversation, and that is, should we be trading with the Chinese or should we be trading with our friends? Trade is going to be better for all of us, but not necessarily we should be helping China develop its military with the proceeds from the sale of toys and goods and all sorts of things. So I think this is an important conversation that we absolutely have to have. And we should be applauding our president for starting this conversation.
Well, I guess the question is it a conversation or are we really at the action stage? The president, as you know, in those tweets indicated that he was no longer going to allow this practice of continuing, whereby the Chinese benefit from trade, as you say, but don't help on the North Korean front. So it sounds as though he's poised to ratchet this up considerably, and the Chinese may well decide to push back. We'll again be talking about some of how they may do that momentarily with Kevin Freeman. Let me turn to another topic with you, Gordon, and that is the announcement that a Taiwanese company, Foxconn, is going to be making a major investment in this country. And whether it'll materialize this time, I gather there have been some false starts in the past. And if so, what are the strategic implications of that? Not just the economic, but does this suggest a considerable rapprochement with Taiwan that may have implications in this other context with the Chinese as well?
Last Wednesday, President Trump announced the $10 billion investment by Foxconn into Wisconsin. And on the following day, Foxconn signed a memorandum of understanding with Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker. You know, I'm not sure that we're going to see 13,000 employees at this plant, as Foxconn says. But nonetheless, we are going to see a substantial increase in employment in probably the southeastern corner of the state. They're going to be making liquid crystal displays. This is important for the United States. And I think it's important for manufacturers as well, because they're starting to see trade and geopolitical risk. They want to be closer to their customers. And so therefore, I think the United States is going to be the world's next factory floor, as companies understand that they have got to start building things in the United States. This is a very good trend. It's called reshoring, and I think it will continue, including with Foxconn.
But to this question, Gordon, about sort of the strategic implications of this, is this going to signal to the Chinese a policy approach somewhat more akin to what Donald Trump signaled at the very beginning of his administration, a kind of to-China attitude that may stoke some of those nationalist sentiments on the part of the Chinese we talked about earlier?
Well, the Chinese are just moving in the wrong direction on nationalism, and I'm sure that they're not happy with Foxconn making this big investment into Wisconsin. I think it's going to help, and as you pointed out, this is also going to be good for our relations with Taiwan, because Foxconn is Taiwan-based. But the Chinese can see that they're going to lose Foxconn investments in the future because the company has announced investments around the region. Many of them have not materialized, but nonetheless, we see an attempt to move out of China on the part of Foxconn. And that's also true of other manufacturers. So this is going to be good for the United States, and it's not going to be good for the Chinese. I think China's status as the factory floor has just sort of reached the peak. That's going to anger the Chinese, but this is economics. Once it benefited them, now it's going to disadvantage them. That's great for us.
It does seem to me really important if this can be encouraged to say, as you say, Gordon, not only for domestic economic considerations, but also to encourage companies to stop essentially dancing to the Chinese tune, which, as you know better than most, has involved, among other things, giving up the seed corn of their technologies in the process. Gordon Chang, we have to leave it at that for the moment. Thank you so much for your time today and for the great work you do at The Daily Beast, Forbes.com, WorldAffairsJournal.com. Next up, we'll speak with Kevin Freeman. We'll get into some of what the Chinese are up to, including using Alibaba's immense resources and squeezing Apple. That and more straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. It's my pleasure to say we are joined, as we have the privilege of being each week, by my friend and colleague at the Center for Security Policy, our senior fellow with the Economic Warfare Portfolio, Kevin Freeman. Kevin is well known to those of you who have listened to this program. His commentary and analysis on matters involving national security, but more broadly, economic warfare and the danger that it poses to our economic and national security interests is really without parallel. He is the author of two best-selling books, Secret Weapon, How Economic Terrorism Brought Down the U.S. Stock Market and Why It Can Happen Again, and also Game Plan, How to Protect Yourself from the Coming Cyber Economic Attack. You can follow his writings easily at globaleconomicwarfare.com, and soon you will be able to follow him at the Blaze Network, where he will be hosting Economic War Room with Kevin Freeman in the near future. Kevin, so good to have you back. Thank you so much for taking some time.
Oh, happy to be here, Frank.
You've recently written at globaleconomicwarfare.com about global turmoil and the peculiar fact that so far the U.S. stock market doesn't seem to be getting the memo that there's a lot of turmoil, in fact, around the world. First, let's talk about some of that turmoil, and then second, explain to us why you think the folks on Wall Street aren't seemingly alarmed about it.
There are just so many things. You cover them on your program that are concerning. Some of them systemic, some of them just nuisances. But we see evidence, for example, that the North Koreans are advancing their missile technology. They're practicing submarine launches. They're moving their submarines in unusual ways. All of these things could lead to a missile, ICBM, that could hit the United States potentially with a nuclear weapon, or it could go into space and set off an electromagnetic pulse. That's a frightening thing. The stock market seems to have ignored it. Every time that there is a launch or something, there should be some reaction in the market. Just completely ignores it. And the Middle East conflict with the Qataris and Saudi Arabia, that's a threat to Middle Eastern peace. There's the collapse in Venezuela, which with the government just completely taking reins and a potential civil war. In our hemisphere, a major oil supplier to the United States and the owner of refineries here, there's the Chinese debt problems, there's cyber attacks and all of these, and yet the stock market continues to move to higher and higher levels.
So what's going on, Kevin Freeman? You're a chartered financial analyst. You've specialized in financial matters for most of your career. How could it be that stocks are not reflecting at least some of this looming uncertainty, if not potentially really horrific disruption?
Well, a couple of things. When the markets are down and you have this plethora of threats around the world, it's called climbing a wall of worry. And stocks, if they're underpriced, then they should move up. But when stocks are at all-time high levels, it looks a little more like euphoria. Now, we do see good corporate earnings, and that's been a big factor in the market. The earnings have come in better. But the earnings are all tied to these kind of events. For example, today, Apple will work their earnings, but Apple is tied up into China and so forth.
Yeah, and I'd wanted to come to that specifically because you've been analyzing this for some time. But again, I wanted to just tie back into something we talked about a moment ago with Gordon Chang, Kevin Freeman, and that is China's increasing assertiveness as a particular threat to our economy and vital interests, both in that region, but increasingly globally. One manifestation of its power these days would appear to be Apple's submission to its demands with respect to something called VPNs. Talk about that, if you would.
Well, as you recall, Frank, with the San Bernardino shooter, they got his iPhone and they were wanting to unlock it, and they asked Apple's help in unlocking. Oh, no, we have to protect the privacy rights of our customers. And so, you know, here's a clear terrorist activity, and Apple stood their ground. China has said, you've got to remove these VPN applications off of your iPhone. And a VPN is it's an encrypted tunnel that allows someone who has an iPhone in China, for example, to access a server outside of China where they could then surf and look at websites that maybe the Chinese government has forbidden. So it's a true freedom opportunity. Apple said they're illegal, we'll remove them from China, and now Russia is demanding that they be removed from iPhones sold in Russia. So we see Apple kowtowing to foreign entities, foreign governments, but refusing our own government. It's a frightening proposition.
Yeah. Well, to say nothing of what it means that they're abandoning instruments of freedom that they have heretofore provided to the people of places like China and Russia. Gordon Chang is also concerned, of course, as I know you are, about something you touched on a moment ago, and that is North Korea. The Trump administration seems determined to up the ante, especially apply increasing pressure on the Chinese. You and I have talked about this over the years a lot, including, I think, as recently as last week. But I just wonder, in light of what seems to be teeing up here between the United States and China, do you anticipate, Kevin Freeman, that the Chinese will retaliate by restricting our access to rare earth minerals? And if so, what would the effect be?
Well, I don't have any doubt that the Chinese will restrict their access to rare earth minerals. The only question is the timing. Is this when they want to fire that bullet? And they have it in their gun. They've prepared a long list of weapons, economic warfare weapons to use. This is a serious one. And if we ratchet up pressure regarding North Korea and they don't want to conform, then they very well could either threaten or use it.
And as you say, this is just one of a number of instruments at their disposal, and this is why we value so much your analysis, Kevin Freeman. You have been among those on our team who have been expressing concerns about, well, initially the IPO that a company called Alibaba issued on Wall Street a few years ago with a stunning revenue-generating effect. Some of that money is now coming back to the United States, but in an unsettling way. Talk, if you would, quickly about that.
Well, China has been actually around the world using the capital raised from Alibaba and the money that they generate from selling their goods and services here in the United States. $25 billion was raised in the IPO of Alibaba, and they've been going around Silicon Valley buying up any emerging startups with that capital or making serious investments that give them controlling interest.
And the implications of all of that for our long-term economic as well as security implications should be obvious to everyone and ominous at that. Kevin, lastly and very quickly, there is, as you mentioned earlier, a growing danger of electromagnetic pulse threats to this country, including from places like North Korea, for crying out loud. I'm told that yesterday was the last day of the Congressional EMP Threat Commission.
Well, it's a serious problem because in our nation, the power industry does not want to discuss EMP and the threat that's involved there. It would cost them money. It would take away some of their control of their industry and give it to government, which I generally oppose, but in the case of national security, I'm all in favor of. But the EMP Commission gave an official voice that could stand up to the voice of the power industry and say, no, this is a genuine threat. It has some of the greatest experts, and yet now, yesterday was the last day for it. It must be reconstituted or brought back together in some form, because these people tell us the threat and they have the scientific background and understanding to explain it, and now it's been disbanded.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more, and they also have done signal work in terms of explaining to us what needs to be done to mitigate that threat, something we can do, folks, but we need their expertise to guide us in it. I hope the Pentagon will take in its new leadership corrective action on this one. Kevin Freeman, thank you so much for your time today. As always, your work is deeply appreciated at the Center for Security Policy. Check it out, folks, at globaleconomicwarfare.com. We'll talk with you again next week. Next up, Stephen Bucci, the Heritage Foundation, joins us. We'll talk about Russian sanctions and retaliation and transgenders. Should they be in the military? That and more straight ahead.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
We're back. It's a great pleasure to say, joined by Dr. Stephen Bucci. Well, I could say Colonel Stephen Bucci. I could say Secretary Stephen Bucci. He's a man of many parts. These days, a visiting fellow at the Douglas and Sarah Allison Center for Foreign and National Security Policy at the Heritage Foundation. But he has served both in uniform in the Special Forces of the United States Army and in the higher ranks of the United States Defense Department, both as a military assistant to then Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld and as a Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense in his own right. He's a great resource on matters involving sort of traditional defense issues and more broadly the strategic environment in which we find ourselves, and it's always a pleasure to have a chance to talk with him. Stephen Bucci, welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio.
Well, thanks for having me back again, Frank. It's always a pleasure.
Well, good. Let me ask you about Russia, Steve. You've spent most of your professional life confronting them in one form or fashion or another, the Russians. What do you make of the current state of affairs? Specifically, I'm thinking of the sanctions that the Congress has now enacted, President Trump says he'll sign, and the retaliation, therefore, from Vladimir Putin. It's kind of a subset of the larger dynamic between our two countries, notably one that is being commented on as we speak by the Vice President of the United States as he tours some of the potential flashpoints on the periphery of Russia.
Well, I mean, this is a pretty serious issue. The Russians continue to be our most dangerous threat just because of their capability. They're the only country even close to us in capabilities of nuclear weapons. And frankly, President Trump, I think, is figuring out that, like President Bush and President Obama, who both reached out to Russia early in their terms, that Russia's hard to deal with. Mr. Putin is a tough guy to negotiate with, and he follows Russia's national interests, not some global fallacy that other people might think is out there.
And to the extent that he is pursuing that, Steve Bucci, where does it lead? It seems pretty clear that between his nuclear buildup and the positioning of forces, as Mike Pence has pointed out, in both Estonia and Georgia are really at very close hand for both of those countries. Are we looking at a Russia that is likely to engage in still more aggression, do you think?
Well, I think we need to be prepared for that. One hopes that Mr. Putin will be faced with strength from President Trump and from our other NATO allies. God help our most recent NATO allies that are there in the Baltics and that area, because when he's faced with strength, he tends to back down. He's a traditional bully, and hopefully that strength will deter him. If it doesn't, though, we need to be prepared for it because, you know, I mean, just the tyranny of space and time, the Russian military is a heck of a lot closer to our Baltic allies than we are. And we don't have any particular strength in that area anymore. So it's a very daunting task to convince Mr. Putin to back down and play nicely.
I was struck by Vice President Pence's rather more fulsome affirmation of the United States' commitment to the security of the Baltic states, or Article 5 treaty commitments under the NATO treaty. Were you surprised by that as well? And if not, Steve Bucci, was that the right signal to be sending in terms of, as you say, presenting a show of strength and commitment and resolve to Vladimir Putin?
I think Vice President Pence's statements in that area were spot on. Is the policy of the American government. President Trump and Vice President Pence are working these issues very well in tandem. President Trump reaching out to Russia to a degree, but, you know, letting people know that we can't be pushed around. Vice President Pence, you know, playing the good cop, if you will,
being much more sort of reasonable and as you say, more fulsome, more explanatory with what that means. It kind of fits both their personalities. I think Russia's getting the message, but I think they're doing, you know, this is not just by happenstance. President Trump and Vice President Pence talk to one another, and I think they're working this issue pretty well.
As a tag team. Let me switch gears on you, Steve Bucci, to take advantage of your past and considerable experience in the United States military. I know that you've commanded special forces units of the United States military. You've obviously been at the right hand of the Secretary of Defense, overseeing the rebuilding of our military. What do you make of the president's decision to prohibit the service of transgender, as they're called, transsexual, transgender, whatever, individuals in the armed forces of the United States? Is it a sensible thing to have done? And if so, are you surprised that some Republicans have been quick to criticize him for doing it?
Well, I am in favor of President Trump's tweet. I wish he would have been more explanatory about it, and I think that will come. He's sort of given the intent to his folks, and now they've got to operationalize it, because I think what his reason for it is, he's not trying to be mean to transgender people or rob them of a chance of serving the country. He's pointing out that the cost of the surgery and treatment and therapy that those folks have to go through if they're going to make a transition is extremely prohibitive. And while you're going through all that, which can take years to complete, you are non-deployable. Both those aspects make service when you're in that process incompatible with the, you know, good order and discipline and efficiency. And President Trump is more concerned with readiness and our capability to fight than he is with the social experimentation and who's being nice to whom. So I wish he'd explained all that, but, you know, that's kind of not his style, and that'll come. But I think it's the right decision, and the Republicans who are fighting him on it need to dig in a little more before they make a position known to see that he's actually doing the right thing.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. And well said on both calling on him to further explain, and I think you're right, he will, but also on the Republicans and, for that matter, others, national security experts and the like, who are now caviling about this to do their homework. Lastly, and very quickly, Steve Bucci, let me ask you about another subject on which you're expert, missile defense. We touched on the Russian threat that is emerging, nuclear and otherwise. The Chinese, similarly, are making great strides. How are we doing with respect to our missile defenses, and what should we be doing to ensure that they're up to the challenge, particularly of emerging hypersonic and supersonic maneuvering capabilities on the part of these adversaries?
Missile defense is better than it's ever been. It is doable and is helpful, and frankly, we need to do a ton more of it, because these threats are getting more and more sophisticated. Right now, our missile defense capability could not stop Russia or China if they did a full-up ICBM attack on the United States. There, we're dependent on our own deterrence to them, that they understand we would survive and we'd rain a lot more destruction on them than they could rain on us. The problem is really with North Korea and Iran, who are very different dynamics, look at us very differently and are seemingly far less deterred by that kind of threat than a country like Russia or one like China. But both Russia and China, frankly, could be helpful with us. Russia in backing Iran off, because they're very friendly with Iran, and clearly China backing North Korea off. Both those big countries need to help us get these smaller countries down where they're less threatening. Right now, they're not inclined to be as helpful as they could be, and we need to put pressure on them to get them to do that. But our missile defense capability is critical. We need to improve it. We need to continue to invest in it, because if we don't, we're putting our citizens at great risk.
Amen to that. Well, look, I hope you're right, that it's up to snuff, or that we will be making it so shortly. It is urgently needed, as you know, Stephen Bucci, and I'm not holding my breath on help from the Russians or the Chinese, so that makes it all the more necessary indeed. Thank you for your time today and for the great work that you do and have for so many years for our country in uniform and in the public arena, as well as, of course, at the Heritage Foundation where you are today. Come back to us again very soon, my friend. Stay well. Next up, we'll talk with Luis Fleischman about Venezuela in freefall. What should the United States do about it? That and more, straight ahead.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
We're back. We're joined by Dr. Luis Fleischman. These days, he is a senior advisor to the Mengus Hemispheric Security Project at the Center for Security Policy, where he edits its terrific publication online, The Americas Report. Dr. Fleischman is also an adjunct professor of political science and sociology at the Wilkes Honor College at Florida Atlantic University. In addition to many, many publications, including one we'll be talking about today at securefreedom.org, check out Dr. Fleischman's terrific book, Latin America in the Post-Chavez Age, The Security Threat to the United States. Luis, you've been warning about that security threat for some time. It's good to have a chance to visit with you about how it looks today. Welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio.
Thank you so much, Frank. It is a pleasure to be here in your program again.
Good. Let me ask you about the referendum, Luis. Over the weekend, of course, what many have considered to be probably the kiss of death for what was left of democracy in Venezuela has now been accomplished with a referendum completely rigged, it appears, to validate Maduro's takeover of that government lock, stock, and barrel. Is that how you see it? And what are the implications of its outcome?
In the intention of Mr. Maduro, yes, indeed, this is like a consolidation of a democratic, dictatorial regime. And I think, you know, the way the White House called it is true. I mean, it's a dictatorial regime. We are talking about a weakened government, a government that is not legitimate. The opposition acted extremely wisely by having a popular consultation 2 weeks earlier on July 16th that showed basically support for the opposition and delegitimization of the Maduro government by a participation of about 8 million voters on July 16th. It is estimated that for the dictatorial constitution that Maduro tried to elect the Constituent Assembly for, there was a participation of about 2 million people, so about one third.
I thought that they were claiming that it was 8 million as well, but not so, huh?
Well, they were claiming that, but the opposition claimed otherwise, and the objective of observers, foreign observers, basically talked about lines that were empty. You know, the electoral posts were and polls were relatively empty and quiet that day.
Yeah, that's a bad sign for the government. It shows, again, what the people of Venezuela are profoundly suffering at the hands of the regime and the economic disaster that it has imposed upon them. It's also, last night apparently, started rounding up leaders of the opposition, including rearresting one of their eminent figures who was only just recently released from jail, Leopoldo. Talk about that, if you would.
First of all, the strategy of the opposition is to use the referendum of July 16th to organize and to continue these demonstrations against the government of Maduro. So it is obvious that Maduro and is extremely self-conscious that his government is not legitimate. And so at this point, he's trying to suppress all the sources of opposition. And certainly Nicolás Maduro and Antonio Ledesma, the two people that were arrested, are a threat to Mr. Maduro. I think in Venezuela, Frank, what we are having is we are at the verge of civil war, and this is what is our responsibility to try to avoid it. Not only the Venezuelans' responsibility, but also ours. If there is going to be a civil war, it could end up like in Syria. In other words, Maduro can continue to be in power forever, supported by the Russians. By the way, the Russians are the main suppliers of weapons to the government of Maduro.
In order for there to be much of a civil war, of course, it would be required for the opposition to have access to weaponry as well. Is there evidence that they do at this point?
I mean, I don't think, militarily speaking, the opposition is a match. So it has to be a political victory. And this is why it's so important that the international community steps in.
Let me ask you about that, Luis. The international community has a role to play, and I want to come back to that in a moment. But just in terms of what options the opposition in Venezuela itself has, are there really any as a practical matter other than, you know, getting into a violent conflict?
No, I think it should be civil disobedience and a very strong and a smart political strategy involving the international community and try to encourage defection. I think the hope is that members of the military, soldiers and policemen, would refuse to shoot on civilians because, after all, you know, they are shooting on their own citizens.
Yeah, and in some cases, their relatives as well, it seems. And, Luis, does the Organization of American States have any role to play here? I know that they've been frustrated in trying to take even a stance on Venezuela. Is this likely to change?
The OAS can make resolutions and can make statements and can isolate Venezuela, and they can expel Venezuela from the Organization of American States. But this is a resolution by the OAS. It has proven to be very weak and incapable of enforcing the democratic charter, you know, very much, I would say, contrary to the Europeans that have been much stronger, for instance, with regard to Poland. I think at this point, the OAS, the majority of the members of the OAS already have voted against Venezuela, have repudiated the Maduro regime, indirectly or indirectly. So what the OAS has done is that it has given legitimacy to an international campaign to isolate Maduro. I think if the American government, and particularly the State Department, had been afraid of taking one-sided unilateral steps against Venezuela because they were afraid of being blamed by Latin Americans or being accused of imperialism, whatever. Now they have legitimacy, they have the green light, the so-called permission from Latin American countries to move on and do everything it can to remove Maduro from power.
And what specifically, Luis Fleischman, what should the United States be doing to give effect to that sort of latitude from the Latin Americans now?
Well, I think, Frank, you gave the answer in your editorial today. And at this point, I think the oil sector needs to be targeted. I think we should stop buying oil. Yesterday, there were several people, including Senator Menendez, that warned that if we punish the oil sector, gas prices are going to go up. But I think the American people have to make a decision in whether they want to stand by the values America stands for. And I think it is worthwhile to try. I believe that the oil sector is highly problematic. First of all, it will apply pressure on the government. There is no question about it. Yes, some of the Venezuelan people will suffer. But the most important thing is that it will eliminate CITGO's capability to lobby in the United States. So far, CITGO, which is the American branch of PDVSA, the Venezuelan oil giant, has been able to lobby and to corrupt Washington in ways that are unbelievable. A declared enemy of the United States is also capable of lobbying within the United States.
And on behalf of the Russians, no less, who seem increasingly to own CITGO, it's just an incredible mess. Let me just echo your call for the United States government to bring pressure to bear on this horrific regime to free Leopoldo López, to end its oppression of the people of Venezuela, and to resign from power in the end. That's what needs to happen here, folks. Luis Fleischman has got a strategy for accomplishing that at the securefreedom.org website. I urge you to check it out. Dr. Fleischman, thank you so much for your time today and your leadership in all of these areas. Come back to us again very soon. I hope the rest of you will come back to us again tomorrow, same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.